Fighting his own controls, Mike Wilkes managed to move the TR over Wilton Road. At this point, it was the only route to Oak Road, because County Road 4 forked off from here. If the Callahans made it out of the maelstrom in town, he was going to have to take the boy out personally, and damn the consequences. The problem was the TR. It was leaking gas, losing lift. At some point, the computer would conclude that it was going to crash. It had a self-destruct mode that would vaporize it in seconds, and anybody inside as well. In the operational models, there was an elaborate escape mechanism that could fly the pilot hundreds of miles to safety, but it was not present in this stolen prototype. Then he had seen two cars coming. The one in the rear was the Kelton's wagon. Ahead of it had been the Callahans. When the Keltons had fired on them, he had experienced a surge of relief. This might yet work, and work well, or so he had thought. Now he wasn't so sure. He slid slowly over the woods, looking down, unable to determine the exact situation. There was a distant roar as the last of the elevator tanks collapsed like great drunken giants, leaving a pall of white dust on the golden western horizon. So the transmitter was done now. How much longer would his assassins last? Maybe as much as an hour, some of them, but most would revert to normal almost immediately. The nice ones. He unbuttoned his holster and dropped the ship to ground level. He moved slowly past the Callahan's car, making certain that it was absolutely disabled. As he was ascending again, he noticed that the Kelton's wagon was occupied. Their dog was in the back, barking to be let out. The animal would not revert. Unlike a human being, it would remain savage for the rest of its life. He climbed down onto the road and opened the wagon's rear door. He didn't need to break the glass. Nobody had thought to lock this car. The animal snarled at him, then began to come forward. Quickly he returned to the TR and turned toward the forest. Alarms were tinkling in the cockpit. He would stalk Connor and watch, and if the Keltons failed, he'd go in for the kill. Connor, darting through the woods, heard a helicopter. Then a shot clipped a tree beside his head. He threw himself down as another three bullets hit all around him. Jimbo, about 100 yards away, roared, "Way to go, Dad! I've got him now!" Very suddenly, he was swooped down on, and arms went around him. "Mom!" As Caitlin's arms closed around him from behind, she cried out with joy, "Mom, no! Mom, we have to keep on!" "Honey, it's the Keltons. It's our friends, honey." Then Dad was there, and he was not confused at all. He scooped Connor up and ran like hell. But a shot crackled, and Connor felt his dad's whole body lurch. With a gasp, Dad went down. Connor disentangled himself, but not before Jimbo arrived, his face purple, the axe flashing. Light, the color of pus, flowed out of his eyes. "Get back in the woods," Dad said. Jimbo hurled the axe, which slammed into a tree, its handle ringing from the vibration of the blow. Then Connor heard the helicopter again, this time very loud. He looked up. Inside the chopper, Lauren realized that it was counter-rotating. She knew that this was the worst possible thing it could do, short of losing its blades and falling like a rock. The forest whirled, then she was thrown against the window and almost out the open door. The world was racing now, and she could hear Rob howling in rage as the pilot made the engine shriek and the trees came closer and closer. She watched, mesmerized, until finally they were sweeping past 20 feet below, all immaculate with snow. In herself she became quiet. She was not afraid. She thought, "It's a perfect world," and peace overcame her.
"Go, go, go!"
"What?"
"Jump, woman! Jump or burn!"
There was fire all over the place. Where had that come from? Then she knew that the chopper had hit the trees, and she'd been stunned. The pilot cried out and began to struggle, and was enveloped in flames. She leaped out into a frigid cacophony of snapping pine boughs and sighing snow. Snow that took her into itself like a freezing womb. In summer, the fall would have killed her, but she went down now in a curtain of snow, and struck the ground almost silently. She got to her feet, looked around. "Rob?" Then she saw him. He was bleeding from his back and both arms, and his hair was burned off, but he went charging off anyway. She started to follow him, and then saw out of the corner of her eye a blue flicker as small as the flutter of a bird's wing. It was not spring. There were no birds. It was a child's blue car coat over there through the trees. "Rob, this way!" Lauren ran out into a small clearing, and there before her was a tableau, for the instant frozen as if by the cold. A boy kneeling in the snow, his face flushed, pleading silently toward a much larger boy, who stood with froth on his mouth like a mad dog. In his hand was an axe. A man lay in the snow, the red of blood around him. Dan. Lauren ran toward them. The axe came down, came with blinding speed like the striking head of a snake. Caitlin saw Dan grab the handle of the axe in both hands, and in doing so give Connor time to get to his feet and stagger toward the deeper woods. Jimbo roared with frustration as he took off after him. She ran to Dan, knelt over him. His eyes met hers. "Help him," he said. "Help our son." She looked toward the woods, got up, and ran on. Rob struggled frantically for his gun, and Lauren saw that he was fighting an arm so broken it was almost snake-like. His lips twisted, his face went ashen, but he used it anyway, getting to the weapon, dragging it out of the holster. "Your left hand," she screamed. "Rob, your left hand!" He raised it past his body, so she could see the useless hunk of meat that dripped there. She saw his chest heaving, saw a froth of bile appear between his lips, but saw him still struggling, still trying to raise that pistol. When Mike saw Rob appear at the edge of the clearing where this thing was coming to a climax, he pulled the TR back quickly. Rob was familiar with the TR, and he just might spot it despite all the optical camouflage. As he maneuvered the craft, a soft female voice began a countdown. "Alert. Destruct in 30 seconds. Alert. Destruct in 29 seconds. Mike hammered at the controls, increased the velocity of the plasma, the speed of the fans, and brought the lift level inching back up. "Countdown ends." For a moment he sat absolutely still, hardly breathing. But the countdown did not resume. He activated the secure communication system. It did not matter much if the Air Force found him now. They were going to be too late, and he needed to let Charles know the situation.
"This is TRA-1. I'm going to burp coordinates."
"Negative that.
Charles, can you reach me?"
3 hours.
"I've got progressive damage. This thing is going in sooner than that."
"Do you have the kid?"
"Just about."
"Mike, the president's arresting the trust. Until further notice, consider yourself a fugitive."
What in hell had happened? The president couldn't arrest the trust, could he? Mike wasn't sure, but he was sure that he had a battle to fight, so he forced the issue out of his mind, and instead concentrated on working the TR closer to the boy. He took out his pistol. Charles Gunn, still over Washington, did not like that "just about." To him that meant that the child was not secure, and if that was true, he might never be secure. Charles must not end up in the situation that had destroyed Der Wolf in the 40s, a two-front war. For the Trust, one front would be this monster of a child, using his powers of mind to stay ahead of them and undermine their plans. The other front would be the President and his powers of arrest. He had hesitated to do what he now knew he must. He'd hidden the TR by hanging in a wooded draw in Rock Creek Park. He rose up to the level of Glover Bridge and headed down Embassy Row. He cleared his vision. It was as if the plane around him had disappeared, except for the three control panels and his immediate seating area. He moved low over the buildings, stopping above the Prince Mansion. Just a few voices. Very well. The President was in the White House. As he aimed the TR down Massachusetts Avenue, he opened a small cover under his right hand, revealing a black button. He adjusted his altitude, then activated listening devices. Much clearer voices filled the small area. A press officer on the telephone. Two Secret Service agents chatting about their house cats. The First Lady discussing colors with her dressmaker. Finally, he heard the President's voice in the Oval Office, talking to somebody through an interpreter. He pressed the button. He held it down. The White House kitchen was organized pandemonium. Last night had been the Thai Prime Minister. Tonight, it was the Sultan of Qatar, the second state dinner in a row. The pastry chef was the first to notice something awry. A meringue was shaking wildly. Then he realized that he was shaking, too. In the press room above, Press Secretary Roger Arm said, "We appear to be," as ceiling tiles began to come down. Then the lights went out, immediately replaced by emergency lighting. Voices rose, shouts and screams, some of them terrible screams. In the Vermeil room, the portraits of all seven first ladies fell at once. A moment later, the ceiling followed. In the Oval Office, the President, his chief of staff, and two, then three, then four Secret Service agents were thrown with ferocious energy to the floor, along with the elaborately robed Sultan and his translator. The Resolute desk, made from the timbers of the HMS Resolute, and used by such presidents as FDR, Kennedy, and Reagan, now crashed with a crackling thud into the floor. A moment later, the walls came in, and the whole contents of the office thundered through into the blue room below. From 30 feet away, Charles watched the carnage, directing pulse after pulse toward the building. The private apartments on the roof shuddered and caved in. Then the whole West Wing sank away into a cloud of dust. Charles traveled over the mess, heading for the mall. He moved just inches above the reflecting pool, aiming toward the Washington Monument. High above, the long snout of the scalar weapon now glowed bright red. Every time Charles pressed the button in the TR down below, the red fluttered brilliant white, and a ball of light shot toward the earth. Tourists screamed and ran across the mall as the worst earthquake to strike the area since the Mississippi embayment in 1811 rumbled and rattled. The Washington Monument swayed, its sheer marble facing dancing with cracks. Inside, more tourists scrambled down the stairs. The monument came down almost gracefully, sinking into its own base as it disintegrated. Marble is a soft stone and does not stand up well under stress. Charles circled the collapsing monument, then moved toward the Capitol. Far overhead, the scalar weapon servos emitted flashes as it made fine adjustments. Congress was in session when the balconies swayed like hammocks and crashed down into the House chamber. Fortunately, for all except the observers, few representatives were actually in attendance. The Senate was not so lucky. A ceremony honoring a retiring senator was underway, and three-quarters of the senators were present when the chandeliers began to fall, exploding into the chamber with horrendous loss of life. The quake, finally finding a fault line, spread through the area. The tunnel to the Senate office building caved in. Then the Anacostia Bridge fell. Everywhere people strove to keep their feet, tried desperately to avoid falling monuments and falling ceilings. Charles continued his mad ballet, paying special attention now to the Pentagon. Inside, people held onto their desks or clung to doors and walls, but the tough old structure would not come down. Finally, Charles took his finger off the button. At monitoring stations around the world, the pens of seismographs returned to normal. But the record was clear. An earthquake measuring 7.3 on the Richter scale had struck Washington, D.C. Strangely, the epicenter was located very close to the surface, rather than 3 to 10 miles beneath it. That was normal. Stranger still, no fault line was known that could account for the highly localized event, which had been centered for all practical purposes on the White House. And yet it appeared to be entirely natural. Henry Verona, who had been in a car on the Anacostia Bridge when it collapsed, drowned with the two men who had arrested him. He died furious at Charles and at life, but also relieved because he knew that the trust would now certainly survive. The President died too, crushed beneath the desk he had so proudly accepted as his own, never dreaming that he would come to his end behind it, or rather, under it. Charles grabbed altitude and headed off west-northwest as a flight of F-16s scrambled from Andrews, screamed past him, their engine noise practically blowing out his ears.
"Mike, are you still up?"
"Just about on the deck."
"What's the status of the kid?"
"Unknown."
"God damn you."
Terry and John Kelton came out of the woods, both with high-powered rifles. As they strode past Dan, Terry knelt and fired into the trees. Lauren leaped through the snow, which here had drifted as high as her chest, leaped and struggled in a slow-motion nightmare, feeling the cold of it sear her in places where she had never been cold. She clawed on anyway, because she knew without fully understanding that this was one of those tiny secret moments on which a whole future turns. She saw John laugh and stride forward so powerfully that the snow seemed to part for him like the Red Sea, as if he was helped in some way by the purity of evil itself.
"Rob!" Lauren screamed. "Rob! Shoot!"
Rob struggled to raise his gun, his whole body shaking with the effort. Three of the Keltons zeroed in on Connor. Lauren saw that they were converging with a fourth, a boy of about 15. She recognized him from that last session with Adam. He had the hair, the face, the build of the image of the boy that Adam had put in her mind and that she had described so carefully to Mike.
"Oh, Mike, you are good at what you do."
He had turned the Gray's own decoy into one of Connor's assassins. She broke free of the drift and ran hard, but all the hunters except the 15-year-old were too far ahead of her.
"Rob!" she shouted in his direction. "Rob, stop them!"
Rob stood still as if he had frozen, and Lauren feared for a moment that he had done just that. But that limp, flopping arm still came up, still carried the heavy pistol. He grimaced in agony, his face now lined with bars of frozen blood. She watched the shattered arm rise impossibly higher and higher, the gun wavering in it. Then she launched herself in a final burst and took down Jimbo. He exhaled with a whoosh and fell, and she grabbed his shoulders and kept smashing his head into the ground as hard as she could, so hard that it soon packed the layer of snow beneath it and began to make thudding sounds, and his eyes began to roll. Rob raised the gun higher, higher, and kept raising it up right past the hunters.
"Rob! Rob, wake up!"
Rob's face worked, his eyes rolling. She looked up to where the gun pointed and cried out, astonished, a red-hot knife of terror stabbing her heart as she saw just a few feet overhead a gigantic shimmering triangle that looked so much like the sky above that she hadn't noticed it before. The gun blasted, and Rob hissed through bared teeth in his agony as the kick flashed torment down his arm. With his mangled left hand, he shoveled snow against his face to force consciousness back, and fired into the thing overhead again and again.
"Alert! Auto-destruct in 10 seconds. 9. 8.
As Mike twisted the controls, the TR wheeled away from the clearing, its huge wings skimming the treetops, leaving behind billows of snow.
5. 4.
He slid down to the hatch. The treetops were 5 feet below him. He leaped. As he did, he felt a fierce blast of heat from the dying TR. He crashed down among the wide pine branches and landed hard in a billow of snow. He checked himself, got to his feet, and realized that his ankle was broken. Rob Langford stood not 10 feet away. Mike's pistol was gone, but he began to hobble toward Langford anyway.
"Rob, you've got to help me."
"I can't do that, Mike."
"Rob, you don't want the whole human race loaded with chains. You're too good a man to want a thing like that."
"They're not loading us with chains, Mike. They're giving us wings."
"How the hell would you know?"
As Rob stood staring at him out of filmed eyes, Mike dragged himself closer. He watched, as if in a balletic nightmare, as Rob's pistol slowly rose from his side, clutched in a hand that looked like gnawed meat, and braced by a burned claw. The pistol came to bear. He saw Langford's teeth grinding, his eyes squinting with effort. He was almost on him now, just a couple more feet. But the hammer went back, and he knew he had lost. Three. The gun went click. Again.
Click. Langford dropped it into the snow and Mike reached him, shoved him back, and pounded him in the face with all his might. But Langford was also a powerful, resourceful man, and he fought back, finally hurtling Mike off him with his feet, sending him sprawling in the snow. Mike tried to get up. He pushed at the ground and struggled with all his strength to raise himself, but he could not. More than just an ankle was broken. He knew that from the blood frothing his lips. Then a fist came down, and the lights went out. Somehow Rob got to his feet. Somehow he moved toward the clearing. He hoped that Wilkes would be out at least for a couple of minutes, but he knew the colonel. The colonel was one to be reckoned with. Screaming in agony, he forced his mangled hand into his pocket. As he got a fresh clip into his pistol, he gagged, bent double, and retched from the agony of using the hand. Step by agonized step, he moved toward the tableau in the clearing. His uniform hung in tatters. Blood gushed down his right arm and left a frozen trail in the snow. Now the gun came back up, this time pointing toward John Kelton. John raised his rifle, but he was not a military man, and Rob got off the first round, which sent him flying back 30 feet into the trees. It hadn't been a fatal shot, Rob saw, as John clutched a bleeding shoulder. Snow cascaded down around Terry, who cried out when he saw his dad go down. Mrs. Kelton came rushing through the woods screaming. Good, Rob thought, they were distracted. He prepared to shoot them both the moment he had clear lines of fire. Dan lay in the sanctity of his wounds, looking into the peace of the darkening sky. He remembered Caitlin on the catwalk, in the secret world of their childhood, when the Greys had stitched their lives together. He remembered her thin summer nightgown, and that face. Caitlin, in the summer of her girlhood, became what he would take with him if now was when he traveled on. Lauren got off the inert form of the Kelton boy she had taken down. In that moment, Rob appeared. He looked through his one unswollen eye, like a stone the pistol dropped from his hand. His head lolled to his chest.
The others are coming, he slurred. Got to stop them, Lauren.
As he toppled forward, Lauren shouted, Somebody help him! But there was nobody to do that. Rob was so caked with frozen blood he looked like he was wearing the uniform of a butcher. She went down to him and embraced him, telling him that she would save him. She ripped off her own parka and put it under his head. He smiled a little.
You're gonna freeze your ass, he said.
Then his eyes closed in the way people's eyes close when they are dying, and she cried out again, Help us! Somebody help us! Suddenly the eyes opened. They bored into hers.
You've got work to do, soldier.
Crying, begging God for his life, she picked up his pistol and ran to do her duty in the woods. It was dark and silent in among the trees. She peered ahead. Every time she moved, snow came in cascades off the pines. But the movement of others was easy to follow because their passing had done the same thing. She listened. At that moment, a shocking and, she thought, totally inappropriate thing happened. She was plunged back into her babyhood and was walking again for the first time. That was Adam's signature. But Adam was dead, so... She saw movement in the woods, a shadow back among the branches that had a great soft eye like a deer. At that instant, Connor, who was running blindly, saw Lauren's face in his mind just as clearly as if she'd been on a TV screen 5 feet in front of him. Her eyes were full of a very special sort of light, pure blue as the sky, tinged at the edges with a million other colors, the richest, most beautiful light he had ever seen. She saw him also in that moment, as if at the end of a tunnel of light that wound through the trees. She struggled forward in a haze of cascading snow and whipping branches, and the light gleamed on the snow, elusive, disappearing at moments, then coming again. Before she could reach Connor, though, a figure was there, the older of the two teens. He had a rifle, and he was pointing it. Then Connor came into view. The kid turned toward him. Lauren raised Rob's pistol, and in one motion fired, and the shooter flew into the snow and lay still. Then she moved toward Connor. He turned toward her, looked from her face to the pistol, and literally disappeared before her eyes. She still saw him, but only in her mind's eye, standing there staring fixedly at her. Like Adam had done, exactly like Adam. She went down on one knee, put the pistol in the snow, and said, "Connor, Connor, I won't hurt you." She projected an image of herself hugging him. Instantly, an image came back into her head from Connor, of him begging silently with his hands. "I won't hurt you," she said in her mind, in exactly the same way she had talked to Adam. There was a flash of movement before her, then another, this one more clear. Then he was standing there again. She threw her arms around him and lifted him to her. Her mind and his mind seemed to swirl together, and it was sheer pleasure and joy, like counting every number to the highest number, and knowing that there would be ever more perfect numbers ahead. Caitlin came out of the woods. As Connor went to his mother, Lauren asked him, "Where are the other shooters? Can you tell?" "Close your eyes," he said. She saw an image of a man lying at the bottom of a ravine with his shoulder bleeding, a woman bending over him. They were huddled together, obviously desperate, trying to keep warm. John and Mrs. Kelton had given up the fight and moved to safety. Connor asked Lauren, "What's happening?" "It's going to end, honey. Very soon, it's going to end." His face turned red. He grabbed her shoulders. "What is it? Why do they hate me?" "Connor, it's going to end. It has to end." He pushed back from her, his eyes rolling back into his head. "Dad needs us." They began running then, all three of them coming out of the shock of the moment, realizing that lives still depended on them. They found both Rob and Dan and Terry Kelton nearby huddled in the snow. As it turned out, Lauren had missed, and he wasn't even wounded, just in shock. His eyes were glazed with fear, and he kept shaking his head. "What? What?" he whispered. "What?" He'd come out of it. Whatever Mike had done to him, whatever evil, evil thing. Dan was still alive and conscious, and as they lifted him, Connor took off his own jacket and tucked it around his father. Lauren hurried to Rob. The moment she looked at him, she began to weep. She reached out and touched his graying face. The eyes stared. The lips lay open, as if amazed by a death that had been also a discovery. With trembling fingers, she closed the eyes. Then she doubled over, gasped, and began to grieve. Connor came. "He's not dead," he said, as if that was the strangest idea in the world. He laid a hand on his forehead, and Rob's eyes flickered open. "See?" Rob gazed up at her, silent. She looked to him, then to Connor, then back to Rob. "Help us," Connor said. Caitlin was trying to get Dan to his feet. "Let me look," Lauren said. She'd had standard survival and first aid training, and she saw that he had a bullet-pierced shoulder. The bones were intact. The shoulder, while dislocated, had not been shattered by the bullet. There was blood, though, a lot of it. "You need a hospital," she said, "right now." On the way to the car, she saw more movement in the woods beside them. She whirled, but there was nothing there. To her horror, she realized that she had left the pistol behind. That had been stupid, but it was also a warning that she was in shock. She had to be careful now, force herself to stay rational for them all. Survival, always, was in the details. The movement came again. Dan saw it too. "A deer," he gasped. "Connor?" she asked. He waved her to silence. They continued to the car, the five of them, following the tracks that had been laid in madness and terror. Dan cried out in pain, but they managed to help him across the Niederdorfer's fence. Once on the other side, he leaned on it. "Give me a second. A second." "We need an ambulance," Caitlin said. Lauren opened her cell phone. Fortunately, they were close enough to the town for a signal. She called Alfred, got through to Rob's adjutant, and reported Rob as severely wounded, and the pilot as a KIA to a very saddened young man. Then she arranged for air evac. Because of the trouble in the town, it might be delayed, but there was nothing more they could do. The Air Force would come and gather its dead pilot and take him home in a box where he would lie in honored earth and the memories of those who loved him. but maybe Rob would live to fight another fight. Are you going to marry him? She actually laughed a little. If I can. Caitlin gave her a questioning look.
Terry, Connor said, your mom and dad are okay.
He looked at Lauren.
There's another one out there.
I know. Rob.
No, alive. Near Rob. He's crawling. He's trying to get to me.
Can he, Connor?
Connor shook his head.
What are you talking about? Dan asked.
Nothing, Connor said quickly.
Lauren heard in her mind. Don't tell them. I can hear their thoughts.
No, Connor, I won't.
Dan touched the implant in his ear. It almost seemed as if he had heard Connor talking again, his voice curiously gentled, coming from the center of his own head. He would have to understand this, but not now. Now he had to save his family. He leaned on Caitlin as they walked, and she whispered, I love you, Dan. I've remembered it all, and I love you. He turned to her. As much as he hurt, those words filled him with a torrent of swirling, strengthening relief. He raised his arms and held her, felt her against him, and felt in his depths the love that defined his soul for his Caitlin. She raised her face to his and kissed him, and the kiss seemed to give him new life, until a wrong movement sent a firebrand of agony through his shoulder. Tears in his eyes, he managed a smile as he went toward the car.
The spare, he said. I'll change the tire.
We'll change it, Lauren said. The light was almost gone now, but they weren't but 200 feet away from the car.
We'll drive straight out the Wilton Road, Caitlin said, and take you to the hospital in Berryville.
Unless this insanity is all over the place. Is it, Lauren? Do you know?
Hold it.
Lauren could not believe what she was seeing.
Don't move.
An enormous dog had jumped onto the roof of the Callahan's car.